Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what's a podcast?
A podcast is a thing humans invented to procrastinate from doing important things, like actual work or spending time with their families.
Neat. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to season two of The Good Place, the podcast. Here again, there will be spoilers. We're going to talk about the entire second season, obviously all of the first season. So if you haven't seen both, please go check out the episodes on NBC.com or the NBC app. On this week's episode, we're talking about the season two premiere, chapters 14 and 15, Everything is Great. Directed by Trent O'Donnell, guest cast includes Tia Sirkar, Luke Gulden, Steve Berg, Paulina Bougembe, Susan Park, Marcus Ray, Amy Okuda, John Hartman, Monet Michael, Bamba John Bamba, Hayden Zedo, Joaquin Ticonderoga, and Josh Siegel. After Michael has erased the memories of the four humans, they wake up in a second iteration of his torture experiment with all new soulmates. Michael rallies the demons to prove to Sean that his second version will be more successful, but Vicky is dissatisfied with her new role. Eleanor uses the note she left herself inside Janet's mouth to find Chidi and to start putting together the pieces even faster than the first time. Chidi is made to choose between two soulmates. Jason tries to escape his clingy soulmate. Tahani deals with a soulmate who doesn't value materialism. Michael plans for Eleanor to get drunk at the welcome party, but instead Tahani does. Eleanor admits to Chidi that she doesn't belong in the good place and subsequently reveals to the other humans that they're in the bad place. Michael reboots the humans for a second time, but doesn't tell Sean. My guests today are the writers of the episode, Jen Statsky and Joe Mandy, and the director, Trent O'Donnell. Jen, Joe, and Trent, welcome. Everything is great.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
First things first, with this episode, what went into the decision-making process, you may or may not know this, about the previously on, because it's a giant previously on The Good Place that right. sort of recaps a really complicated season one.
Yeah. I mean, I think the goal of this episode, these two episodes, was to do what we did in a full season in one episode.
Yeah.
So you get the full season recap and then you realize, oh, we're doing this whole thing in one episode.
Yeah. And I think it was also just realizing that it would be unkind to the viewers to not do a previously on, because it was just so much happened in season one. And then you know, it was such a serialized show. You sort of need that setup, I think, going into it. So, yeah, I think we kind of always planned on having a previously on. Yeah. I don't know if we knew the length of it at the time, but
Trent, when you signed on, you had seen season one, presumably.
I had, yeah.
You were sort of one of the first directors to come on board that knew everything. Like, you had a little bit of luxury. You know, I was interested to learn that plenty of directors in the first season didn't know the episode 113 twist.
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I did 107 in season one.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had no idea what was...
That's right.
...what was happening. And I think, actually, there was a point where Mike maybe asked me if I wanted to know.
Oh, wow.
And I said no. And then I think the same again season two. He asked me after I'd finished my episodes if I wanted to know what happened. And again, so I didn't know what was happening at the end of season two either.
He does love telling people. I walked through the writer's room a couple weeks ago and he was like, do you want to know season three? And I was like, it's a burden. Like,
yeah.
That's,
yeah.
And I couldn't stop him. Like, he told me.
Right, right.
Yeah. Now, that had to be somewhat daunting, taking on this project, because season one was, you know, perfect. Mm-hmm. Were you worried about directing these episodes? Like, in a sense, all you can do is disappoint.
Yeah, definitely. I had a lot.
You did.
Yeah, I achieved what I set out to do. I was not really, like, I feel like I was such a fan of season one, and particularly getting to watch the end of season one, not knowing.
Yeah.
I felt confident that the people beside me and other people had a good plan for season two. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a show, as a director, that you come onto with such a strong cast and good writers that it's not that it's fail-safe, but
right.
You feel like, you know, I would have to mess it up pretty bad to ruin it. So I kind of look at it as my role is to kind of work with these guys and try to value add where I can,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, make it as good as it can be. But I never felt the pressure of like, oh, I'm going to destroy the show.
That's good. Looking back at 107, were there things that you wanted to do that you were told, we can't actually do that? Things like having Michael alone in a room by himself, you know, seeing Michael by himself.
No, not really. Like, it never came down to, I was never trying to like move anything away from what the overriding story was. It was, you know, it's usually comes down to, as a director, when you're, if you have ideas for particular shots or you want to do like, you know, in 107, I did this like really long track in to Kristen when she, that was the episode where she gets up and says, I'm not meant to be here, mm-hmm. which, you know, was a big moment to me because I thought it was The Good Place at the time. So like there's little things like that you'll have like particular moves and stuff you want to do. But
yeah.
No, I never hit an obstacle like, I don't know why, but that can't happen.
Right.
I never had that.
That's a fascinating reference to her confession, because it's no less important that she did that. That was her first move.
Yeah, and it's
move.
Real for her. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like,
this show is so weird. I mean, it's honestly so weird to try to, you know, looking back at it now for this podcast with the full knowledge of seasons one and two, but also the show itself is so nonlinear. I found, you know, places that where I found myself looking for things. Like, I realized, and I'm curious how you, if you addressed any of these in the writer's room, Michael could have prevented all of this by getting a new Janet. Do you know what I mean? Like, had there not been a note season
right,
one to season
right.
two.
Yes, we definitely did talk
we
about
did
that.
We did talk about that. It was so difficult for him to get a real...
To steal the real
yes,
good
that,
place.
Like, I don't think that was a real option for him. But
right.
that you're not wrong.
Right,
that
yeah.
is,
you established that the storage closet where the Janets are kept, it was kind of, he had to, like, maneuver and, like, slink his way into that to get her. So it would have been difficult. And I think at that point, like, he's just trying to not, even though Sean knows that this thing has gone south once, it's like, he's just trying, he was like, just give me one more shot,
yeah.
trying to make it as, like, this will be fine. It's not a big deal. So I think having to get a new Janet would have been more work.
Raise
yeah,
suspicion
raise
or
more
something.
Suspicion or sure. something. But yes, Janet really forked him over.
What went on in the breaking of this season? Was the writer's room largely the same seasons one and two?
Seasons one and two, yeah. We added a
part,
couple
yeah.
people, but for the most part, it was a lot of the same core group. People season one that came into season two. And I'm trying to remember now, I think when we ended season one, we obviously, you know, knew the twist and everything. And I think, did we talk at all about what this premiere for season two would be at the end of season one? I'm trying to remember.
We had ideas, but I would say the process was almost the exact opposite of season one, where like Mike came in with like a very clear plan for like beginning, middle, and end of the season. And we ended the season in a hole. And I remember we just met up kind of early in the year with like, well, we got to get ourselves out of this hole. Like that was like, we have no plan for the middle or end of the season.
Yeah.
And we just sort of started throwing ideas out
right.
for how the
right.
season could end. And it was so not like that season one.
Yeah. And the thing that I think really crystallized it for us was the idea of like, oh, season two now gets to be Michael's season. We get to see this whole other side of Michael, obviously, because it was such a one-dimensional, you know, it was one-dimensional on purpose season one where he's he's just, you know, playing super nice guy. And so I think for us, it was like that felt story-wise, it opened so much up. And I think for Ted, right, too, as an actor, it felt like opening up this whole other thing. So
as
that
you were saying, there were no limitations to, like, Michael can now be in a room by
himself.
Like,
right. Exactly.
We don't have to hide anything from the audience the way we were, like, so deliberately.
Right. So the engine we had going into season two was like, let's blow up, like, let's explore Michael. Let's build him up, this other side of him we haven't been seeing.
So these two episodes, chapters 14 and 15, are a bit of a Rashomon, right? Like, you're sort of telling we're revisiting the same scene from different people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. You're framing people out so that we don't know who the shots of tequila are passed to, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This feels more complicated than a typical half hour of American network television, right?
Yeah, it was. And we did have to really plan all those sequences with how we... You know, there were moments where we're revealing someone's hand, but we want to use this. And we wanted to, as much as possible, and we did, use the same shots and just sort of like set the same take. So we'd have different cameras. One would be playing for a moment. We'd see the same moment later on in someone else's story, but it was the same take. And then another camera was just focused on, like, you know, the Chidi version of events and then the Tahani version of events.
Right.
So we tried to, as much as possible, like, keep it actually the same takes.
But even things like that party had to have been shot over several days, right?
Yeah, it was like three days or something.
I want to say 3 days, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there was always, we mostly had four cameras almost, and we would call them, like, I remember on that shoot, there was like, this is Jason's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is like Tahani's point of view. And so when there were big stunts and those big kind of, you know, there were those key moments like the one at the bar and then when the Tahani fall and the flames and all that, they were all the same. It was the same sequence, just from a different perspective.
It's funny, your attitude, like, I couldn't mess this up, because, like, you definitely could. It was like that party sequence in particular, like, I was there for a lot of it, and it was so confusing.
Super
as someone who's not a director, just a writer, just like sitting there like, okay, I, like, you were so on top of what exact moments we need to see and from what angle and what, like, sound cue, just in case we need to just use in the editing room, just use a sound cue instead of a visual cue. It just, like, it was high level stuff that I was out of my pay grade. I'm not paid as a director, so I don't know how to do any of that.
No.
I feel like so much of what goes on in the writer's room are you guys just putting your own pet peeves onto the page.
Sure.
Like coffee pods and things like
that's
how much of the things that are bad place or points losers are things that are just things that you like, this just happened to me, I'm gonna, and you know, somebody just cut me off.
I say all of them.
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them. No, it's question. it's all very very much so things that just annoy us. Mm-hmm. Like, I think,
I mean, the amount of time we talk about coffee pods is ridiculous.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes, we're very anti those
Keurig.
Yeah, Keurig. Sorry if they're a sponsor of the show, but they're bad.
Yeah, it's sort of split. I myself and Matt Murray and a couple other people, we have like a whole pour over.
Oh, wow.
Like, station in the kitchen. And so, you know, we take our coffee very seriously.
That's a brand of coffee where you get water to not quite boiling the proper temperature.
Yeah, 210 degrees. We have an electrical kettle that.
And then you drizzle it slowly over the grounds.
Over 52 grams of freshly ground coffee.
Yeah. Joe leaves the writer's room for 3 hours at a time, just gone making this coffee.
Mostly a barista on set,
I was in the writer's room and you were showing me what your lives were like, and I legitimately asked the question, who writes The Good Place? Because there's so much, it does feel like the dorms a little bit.
It's
like,
a tremendous amount of time wasted, yes.
Yeah.
Do all the demons have, you mentioned Steve Berg, who plays Gunner, and then we find out his name is Chuck? Like,
they all have demon names and then their character names in The Good Place. Yeah.
Yes. Though Sean is Sean.
For
you,
sure.
You are Sean.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope so. I can't maintain.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't a resident.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
That was the best part, was giving all these characters names and then season two, giving them new names.
Yeah.
It was
completely lateral, Bill to Mark. It's like, there's no difference. Yeah. Why are we doing this?
Right.
Yeah.
Chuck. And I mean, Gunner's a far more interesting name.
That's true.
Which maybe
That's
he true. Chose for himself. So talk a little bit about having to, was there ever a thought that this first, you know, version two would be successful, that Michael would be able to carry it on for a little while? Or did you know right away in the you know, breaking story process that they were going to figure it out?
We talked a lot about the fact that it would be unsatisfying for an audience member to be so far ahead of where our characters were for too long,
right.
Meaning the audience knows it's not The Good Place, but it'll be frustrating if the characters are spending too much time thinking it is. So we pretty quickly in the breaking of season two were like, let's get Groundhog Day, that idea we had early on, mm-hmm. like, let's get to a point where they're all caught up. Because if we take too long where they're so far behind the audience, it's going to be super annoying.
Yeah,
that's true. That would have been sort of wasted time.
Right. You'd been like, okay, yeah, Eleanor, come on, just catch up.
Yeah,
get
we
to
saw
it.
This already.
Yeah.
Right. But yet you don't want to burn through too much story.
Right.
Like you did not do, for instance, the Groundhog Day episode with all the reboots for like two more episodes, I feel like. Or
it was one, wasn't it? Was it the next one?
I guess it was technically the third episode of the season.
Exactly. Technically
yeah.
the third episode.
I remember that because I remember telling Drew Goddard that I was doing the episode where it's like the whole season in one.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, yeah, I'm doing that like 300 times.
Yeah. Yes.
From
yeah.
a
800.
From a shooting perspective, like I think about Drew's episode and, you know, the entire setups that they did for 1 second.
Yeah.
Of,
amazing.
Yeah. I mean, costumes for 30 background or whatever, and on location at the Huntington.
Yeah. The whole production team did an amazing job with that episode because it was just so many moving parts. It was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, Drew's fine. He did a good job. Okay. Yeah.
Moving on.
I wish he had done the premiere season too.
He knew he could mess it up. I think that was the difference.
Right.
Yeah, he was scared.
He knew he could mess it up. Interesting, in this episode, we find the sort of initial meetings with all the residents that hadn't seen in the first season. We see Tahani and Chidi and Jason. Jason almost blowing it by talking kind of thing until Michael tells him parenthetically that you're a silent monk who can't do anything.
Yeah.
And I love a bit of Jason Mendoza that pokes through. You see his face go like, oh, I think you're talking to somebody else.
Yeah, it was fun to do that, to be like.
My favorite happened to be Tahani, just immediately like, yep, no, this makes sense.
Yes, yeah. No questions asked, of course. I'm in a good place. I accept.
There had to be stylistic things that you were trying to match from Eleanor's first meeting, right? Which is the first moments we see of the show in season one.
Yeah. And a lot of that was kind of like, you know, we pretty much used that template of where we went through with Eleanor to go through with all four characters.
You're dead.
Time. Yeah.
You're in the afterlife. Yeah.
And they were really fun, those scenes. And I think that line you just mentioned, I think that was like a play on the time. That was like a improv little moment, the I accept, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I think that it was scripted as the, that makes sense.
That makes sense.
That checks out.
I accept is so much fun.
Yeah.
We find ourselves talking a lot on the show about the torture matrix and the, you know, specific things that will irk each of these people. Eleanor's being that she, you know, is made mad by people being better than she is, which sadly for her is not very hard to do. And I love the moment when Tahani meets her soulmate, who is very short.
Yeah.
Oh,
and you do a bit of Uncle Buck, Molly Russell's Ward in there. That had to be on your minds, right? Where she can't stop saying short.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Jamila did a great job with that. Yes. Just cannot help saying the thing she's thinking the entire time.
I don't think it's just because I know Jamila and am friends with her in real life. But it's difficult to see her in like denim and cargo pants and things. Like that's odd.
I feel like she had said maybe at when we, she was like, I don't know the last time I wore pants. Like she's just someone who's always wearing like a really cute dress or skirt.
A jumper
and so,
or sundress.
Yeah, jumper. And so it was very funny that this was foreign to her.
She's very fun on set just because she's dressed like 10 times more over the top than anyone else. Like just as like walking around craft services.
Totally. Yeah.
She likes craft service. was a lot of the shot at the Huntington?
Yeah, we shot a lot there. And then we shot like in the mansion was down.
By USC, I think, right?
Yeah. But yeah, we were at Huntington a bit. I remember like scouting Huntington a lot. All the Jason stuff was Huntington.
All the Jason stuff, Tahani and her, which I actually don't even know if it made it in, but we did shoot Tahani and her soulmate walking grounds. Yeah.
That's something that made me laugh in the rewatch yesterday of this was when Jason and Jianyu and his soulmate are sort of stacking meditation rocks, and his soulmate does this, you know, gravity-defying, beautiful temples almost. And he writes, just like a calculator, as boobs and stones. It's just so perfect. Did you know at this point that you were going to do 800 reboots?
Yeah, we did.
Were there ways that you decided not to reveal in this? Like, one of my favorite moments in this show, in this these episodes, are even Jason's had it. He's like, homie, no.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to speak because all crazy.
Yeah.
There seems to be such a delicate balance in this show of, like, what to reveal when. Mm-hmm. And you want to be ahead of the audience, as you say, but you also don't want to, you know, spend it all.
Past stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. We definitely had figured out this whole episode and the Groundhog Day one together. Like, I think we, at least when we wrote this episode, had knew those first three. Yeah. And so a lot of stuff, Groundhog Day was just very fun to pitch on because it was mostly, like, joke things. Like, this, I think this premiere is very, it's very plot heavy. And so we were not necessarily worried about revealing stuff because I think we were saving a lot of, like, just kind of random fun stuff for the Groundhog Day episode.
Correct. I mean, we knew we had to get Eleanor to have a second realization. Mm-hmm. And that was most of the goal, was just to get there again and then have that happen 800 more times, right? So, like, the whole goal was just to get there again. And then the question after episode three with all these reboots is, like, is this some sort of, like, destined thing that mm-hmm. Michael never accounted for, you know? So, but again, yeah, it's just, this was very plot heavy and it involved so many moving parts. And like you were saying, the Rashomon element of, like, one act per character was also, like, a thing we were very deliberate about.
I don't think any other episodes had been structured that way, right?
It's
primarily Eleanor and Michael as the A story kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's so devastating in the season one finale that, you know, in a moment of triumph, Eleanor inadvertently gives away to Michael the way to, you know, their undoing, that she reveals that, you know, or lets him know that it's because he put them together.
Yep.
And it's pretty early on in this that they start to connect and she overhears Chidi's name at the party. And I don't know. It's really interesting to think about, you know, Ted playing Michael, seeing this go, you know, you don't know each other. I don't think he doesn't talk. So walk away.
Yeah.
And that was so much the fun of this episode. And I remember just reading it from the first time, like, coming from season one where we're all with Eleanor, this was the first time we got to see Michael, like, behind the curtain and actually pulling all the strings. And that was fun to play with Ted in that area, because that was sort of, we were sort of figuring that out, like, mm-hmm. how sort of, you know, I think I imagined through season one that he was incredibly efficient and kind of, like, very kind of good at that job. And then it was kind of nice, the moment seeing his little failings and foibles in trying to make it all happen and work, and the way he would sort of, like, you know, dealing with Vicky and all of that kind of stuff, like, just annoying kind of office place stuff that was a really fun element.
Full episodes of The Good Place can be found on NBC.com and the NBC app. We're going to listen to a clip of Michael pulling some strings.
Okay, I know that this kind of large-scale deception is not what you were trained to do. There are going to be days when you're just sick of being around these disgusting humans with their weird, gross little mouths and their stupid elbows. You're going to be tempted to say, screw it. Can't we just go back to HQ and do this the old-fashioned way? Pull out some fingernails, toss someone in an acid pit, fire up the old penis flattener? And sure, that sounds nice, but it also sounds easy. We're all here. because we believe that there's a better way to make humans miserable. And I believe in you. So, torture on three. Ready? One, two, three.
Torture!
And biting!
Nope!
No.
One element of the show that's so ridiculous is that none of this needs to happen. I mean, they have
They have a way to do
torture,
it.
Yep. Yeah. Protocols, and this is just for four people, and it's just because he wants to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just because he's like a Jerry Maguire type, had a better idea for a way to do things, and
that it's taking me back to I think a flashback as well in the architect's office. I love that Michael's boss is like much younger than he is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
A child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just fascinating. Whenever I see town hall, town square scenes with a lot of background actors playing demons, you know, it's always fascinating to think of who gets cast as those people. You know,
yeah.
That can look fake good plays.
Right, right.
But also turn and be demons kind of thing. Like, that's not an easy acting job for anybody. Like,
Yeah, like Gunnar has the face. It's like you totally buy him as a good place dude, but then it's also very funny when he's insistent upon biting.
Yeah, right. In the prior season when he was picking up garbage.
Exactly.
Like he seemed legit.
Just like a jolly, nice guy, yeah.
Which is kind of Steve Berg in real life. You meet him. Mm-hmm. He's lovely. After an hour, you want to get away from the guy.
And he's biting you.
Yeah. So throughout this, these guys are... Michael is popping in and changing things right at the last minute. He puts Chidi in a position where he said, you know, something happened and you have to decide between these two people, one of whom, Angelique, is such a perfect fit.
Yeah.
And Pavita is not. And just when he's about to declare, Michael pops in. And he does the same thing with Eleanor later where he says, he's sort of a misdirect where he leans in and says, you and I both know that you're not like everyone else here. And it provides a wonderful opportunity for Eleanor to sort of say, like, I love mushrooms. And then for her to realize, like, oh, I can honestly say
it's not a lie.
It's an interesting way that you guys have to dole out character development still for Eleanor. Like, these, she has to evolve again. And, you know, leading up to the end of the episode where she declares, like, I may not belong here, but I want to. Like, that's the big linchpin, right? Is that she realizes now. Mike and I talked about in the first episode of the podcast, you know, he said ignorance of that everyone is always making ethical choices. And I said, well, that presumes that they're aware of those choices. And he said that, you know, ignorance of the law is not an excuse for illegal activity. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's all about, you know, Eleanor is all of us, I suppose, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about the little voice, that kind of concept.
What's that?
I'm trying to remember. Where did we introduce that? Do you remember what episode?
I don't remember what episode, but it's the idea that, like, there you have a voice telling you that you're about to make a bad decision or the wrong decision.
Mm-hmm.
And Eleanor says that she kind of throughout her life, there was a little voice that she would hear when she was doing something bad, but she would kind of just ignore it and do it anyway. So yeah, I think that, and I think that's a concept that a lot of people can relate to, just the idea of, you know, maybe knowing when you're doing something and doing it anyway.
Yeah, and I think that that's why I think people have found Eleanor such a interesting and compassionate character, is that, like, she's just kind of selfish in a way that a lot of people are selfish day to day. Like, a lot of people choose to make the easier choice that might inconvenience others. And it doesn't seem necessarily like the type of things that would send you to hell, but if those are the rules and we're counting points, people are losing points a lot every day on small things.
Right. And it was all about, and I think something else that's relatable is that for her, it was so much on Earth, it was like self-preservation. It was about protecting herself and being a lone wolf. She wasn't being malicious. You know, she wasn't someone who was going out of her way to hurt other people. It was just when you are trying to look out for number one and only number one, you're not thinking about other people. And so, yeah, I think that is relatable to people in some way. It's like, well, I'm just doing this because I'm trying to protect myself because that's human.
I ask almost everybody this. Has this show changed your concept of what happens next? What is your concept? What was it before?
I I don't think it has changed my concept of it because I'm just not an introspective person in that way. I just don't think about any of that stuff. No, I just haven't been. I mean, I was brought up, like, me and my two sisters are all different religions because my parents, like, took us to the closest church we lived at at the time.
Oh, wow.
It was never something, like, an afterlife was never something that I'm a total, like, no, we're in the ground.
I mean, yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely changed or made me more thinking about ethical behavior and that type of thing. But I'm a little bit on the Trent side of things of like, yeah, when we die, that's it. you're dust.
So why not be a total asshole every day of every week? What keeps you being pleasant people?
I am a total
asshole.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah. Joe spends a lot of time with me, he'll tell you. I don't know, because, like, then it's just, in a way that, to me, the fact that I don't think there is something after this makes me even more so, like, well, if this is the finite time you have, I don't know. It's like, why wouldn't you be? Everyone else also has finite time, so let's take care of each other and make sure everyone's time is as good as it can be.
I mean, I feel like every day I get to work and I think, am I in heaven? I already make it?
No. Mike, are you listening?
Yeah, Mike. No. It's, I think, a thing we talk about a lot, and it's, you know, part of the reason why Tahani is, we say, why she ended up there. It's like, I think motivation's a big factor. And a thing that I always question people who only do good acts because they think this will earn, I can get into a heaven after I die. That, sure. I feel like that it loses value.
Doing it for the wrong reasons.
Doing it for the wrong reasons, or doing it turns into a selfish act if you're only doing this because, you know, if I don't do this, then I might not get into a heaven afterwards.
It's season two, so we're going to try some new things, including ads.
Promotional consideration provided by Celebrity Baby Plastic Surgery Disasters Magazine. Want all the latest news on the most famous celebrity babies? Pick up the latest issue of Celebrity Baby Plastic Surgery Disaster Magazine, the number one selling periodical in the world. Bringing you all the latest in baby veneers, in utero collagen implants, and spray tans versus snot snafus. How do these babies stay looking so young? Find out with Celebrity Baby Plastic Surgery Disaster Magazine. Just because your skull is soft doesn't mean your abs have to be.
There was some VFX in this episode. I would guess that you didn't actually light curtains on fire, for instance.
We weren't allowed to, no.
Yeah, that was someone's house, right?
Yeah.
but then obviously, Michael checking to make sure that there was no note in the Janet this time.
Mm-hmm.
How do things like that get framed? How do you shoot that and what happens later?
It's usually just a thing where you speak to the visual effects people. They're there on set and you kind of just check in with them and then you put it in your edit and it doesn't really look like anything. And then you get this lovely surprise when you see it on TV and it looks great.
Oh, really? That's the first time that you're seeing it?
Yeah. 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 For a director, the director's cut is generally, I think for this one, I maybe had 4 days because it was a double episode, but it's usually 2 days.
Of editing.
Of editing. And so there's a lot of, like, you know, the editors will do a cut for about a week and then I'll come in and sit with them and, you know, put in the bits that I like and stuff that I sort of want Mike to see.
Sure.
And then, I don't see the final polished one until...
Until it airs.
Until it airs, yeah.
On the front end of it all, how long before you begin shooting do you see the script?
Usually a week before.
That's not a lot of time.
But for this, I think it was a couple of weeks again because it was a double. Like, this was a long period for me on a show where I was sort of here for like a month because I did 2 weeks of pre, 2 weeks of shoot, even more than a month, and then a few days editing where usually you're sort of in and out in 10 days.
And, you know, you're coming in obviously having done 107 and there were 13 previous episodes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still some, you know, I would guess that there are visual things that are established, you know, how the cameras move and mm-hmm. how they like that. But in that week or two before setting up, what are you looking for in the script for what do you highlight as moments that you want to spend time on or are there things that stick out that you go, oh, I know how I'm going to do that?
Yeah, there is, like, there's certain, like, particularly in this in these episodes that had such particular visual moments, mm-hmm. there was a lot of planning.
What things are you thinking of?
All the moments that we were, the Groundhog Day sort of moments that we were repeating.
Okay.
And then you read the script and you look at moments. Like I remember reading it and looking at all the Michael stuff where we were seeing Michael pulling the strings and sort of seeing him as the architect of these four people's lives, that was new territory. And so I remember just making notes in the script and having time there and speaking to Ted about it and to these guys about it. And just you work out the scenes where you feel like you want to spend a little more time.
Okay.
And just, you know, sort of figure things out.
Spend more time visually on screen or just spend more time shooting the scene?
More time shooting.
Okay.
More time, like giving yourself more time on set. So trying to, and then you talk to the first AD about stuff like that as well. Like, you know, I remember the things that were like towards the end of the day was stuff like Jason in the rock garden. Mm-hmm. They were things that they were a visual thing. We kind of know what that's going to be like. We don't need to run 100 options of how and play within a different tone of it. But if it was like Ted kind of like having joy in messing with Chidi and his choices, then right. we wanted to have a moment to work out, oh, how kind of overtly happy can he be in these moments where he's like, you know, behind the curtain. And so that's the areas where we go, yeah, let's sort of play and explore
downshifting.
Right. I specifically remember a moment where it's Chidi dealing with these two soulmates mm-hmm. at the party, and he gets frustrated, and then you rack focus and you see Michael like give a thumbs up, and like I remember just how complicated that moment was. We spent so many like it was so a lot of just like shifting.
Yeah, there was a lot in that party. We was just where like a lot of kind of like overhead maps of where people could be.
Sure.
So where they could mm-hmm. appear in the background of other people's shots.
Right. Exactly. Because like Tahani's reveal isn't for a couple acts in at the bar.
The drunkenness.
Yeah. And, yeah. But like you can't see her in the background of any of the previous shots.
Yeah. So you have an idea of like, well, Tahani is in that corner now, so we can't see there, and things like that. Mm-hmm.
That is really really strange. Something just occurred to me. The rock garden stuff of Jianyu's soulmate, was that VFX or did props build that?
It was built.
Yeah, that was real.
That was practical?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the one where he walks through it at the end, isn't it? Which was like the last take. Because it was like right down to...
Right, yeah.
We were like running out of daylight.
That's really cool. Another thing I love about this episode is that we get another Jason and Janet hug. Like those two are cosmically bound for one another. We talked in a previous episode about them, you know, seeking each other out, being magnetically drawn because they're 10-year-olds, you said. But it's they're going to be connected forever no matter what happens somehow.
I think those moments between them are always very satisfying, I think, to write. And I think people really like the two of them together. And so, it was definitely nice to have a nod to that. It was also like a nod to the audience, I think, of like, don't worry, like the relationships you invested in, we're still going to be like working.
Yeah, it
with
might
them.
Not happen in the exact same way, but people are going to find each other. That was important.
Yeah.
It happens quickly, and it's really satisfying. Like it's, I don't know, you want Team Cockroach to succeed.
Yeah, yeah.
was Eleanor's fake soulmate's mm-hmm. shirt a tearaway shirt? And how many times did you rip that off?
It was a lot of tearaways. Yeah,
I mean that was that happened a billion times, right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was a moment as well. I think we maybe did like ad-lib some of those as well when he was leaving his seat, which goes, now let's do one where you rip your shirt off again.
When he gets in the fight and he's like, I'm out of here. That was not a tearaway, but we're like, we might as well.
There's one moment, and I'm trying to think of what it was. I wondered if he went out of frame. It came off so quickly that it almost felt like he went out of frame and that you took it off and then he popped up without it.
I think we did them all practically.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think they were all practical. Yeah. Yeah.
I
remember just every time it happened, I was just getting mad at how anyone could be that fit.
It's crazy. We came up with this character where you're like, oh, it should be like a hot mailman. Like that's the funniest thing for her. And the actor is a very funny guy named Luke Golden, who had been in an episode of Broad City, a show I work on.
Oh.
And I was like, so when we were talking about, we need a very fit guy who can rip his shirt off and instantly be that. I was like, I think I've got the guy for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's certainly the guy for that.
Yes. Yeah.
Why don't we listen to another clip?
Hey there, boss man.
You were supposed to call me this morning. Give me an update.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah, it's just the chaos sequence was going so well. Better than the first time, in my opinion. Eleanor got completely drunk last night. Talked for like an hour, you know, even flashed somebody. So we had a lot to work with.
So attempt number two is on track so far?
Oh, smooth as silk. Everything's great. Oh, sounds like everything's going well back there, too.
We're trying out the new butthole spiders.
Huh?
They're enormous. You know, good old-fashioned torture, the way it's supposed to be. Good luck with attempt number two. And remember, there will be no attempt number three.
Eleanor, come on in.
Sean doesn't realize this is attempt number three.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot more.
Yeah, Michael lies to his boss. I mean, now he's all in. I will tell you that doing a job like I do, people will sometimes quote things to you when you're in airports and restaurants. butthole spiders gets a lot of play. and I'm remembering that specifically. That was an alt. That was one that wasn't on the page.
Written as toilet spiders. That's the value I bring to this.
toilet spiders.
We can.
Right. Always a butthole pitch. Yeah. Just replacing any word
that's
with butthole.
That's all I do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you make coffee.
I do make coffee. And yeah. Butthole stuff.
Are alts things that you hold back that you hope will make it? Like, because on set, you're shooting the scripted lines 1,000 times.
Right.
And I think that alts sometimes get unfair play. They're often very funny, but I do know that just by being fresh, they play differently and better, right?
Sure. Right.
I know that four camera sitcoms, sometimes they'll save, in front of four camera sitcoms shot in front of a live audience, they will sometimes save what they really want in it so that the audience who's heard it 10 times will go like, oh man, that was unexpected.
That's not how we operate. I mean, like occasionally we have must shoot alts, which are like, we could not choose between a couple options. So we just marked something down as like, we'll just do it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I feel like usually it's something in the moment that just, often it's to speed it up or just to give it a different flavor, but we don't like save better stuff for an alt.
But it is a thing, like even as you're rewriting as a writer, we go over these scripts so many times that it does sometimes you'll be like, should we punch this joke up? And you're like, no, it's really funny and it worked in the table read and it's great. It's just that sometimes when you've seen a joke 30 times now, you're like, oh, this new thing. It's like Mike talks about this a lot. It's like you have to remember, like, oh no, that original joke was what we
it worked.
Yeah,
right.
It worked. Yeah, yeah.
You have to trust. Your
but yeah,
instincts.
We don't do. It's always a thing on set. You want to make sure you get the scripted line.
Yeah. Right.
You want to make sure you've got good takes of that, and then it'll be like, can we play around here, I guess?
And you can feel. I think you can feel on set in the moment, like, you know, because it's always a little different, even. You know, there's stuff that kills a table that suddenly in the environment with the actor in that particular set on the day, I think collectively we can sort of tell that, okay, that can maybe lift in that area and then trying other things. And then I like to just, you know, if there's an area that we think can use an alt, I like to try them, but then not commit. Like I'm very much, I'm not a big like selector of takes on set because I pretty much just want to watch stuff.
Okay.
Later alone in a room.
You're not doing a mental asterisk of like, that's the one.
You know, there's occasionally things, there'll be occasionally moments, but like I remember in that moment of those takes of butthole spiders.
Say that as much as I
can. You know, I remember, like, you can watch it now the way that the edit is set up. Is like, you can literally watch all the takes. At a push of a button, it's like, okay, here are the alts for this one line.
Mm-hmm.
You just watch them over. And it's a different thing. And, like, when you're watching it on the screen in a dark room.
I can remember shooting it. And I'm obviously on this one end of a Skype call. So I'm unusual for most shows looking straight down the barrel of a camera. And I sort of look to my right for where the sound is coming from for the torture with the butthole spiders. And Joe, moments after giving me that line to say, stood directly down my field of vision. And then I could see you laughing. And so I'm certain that in that edit is me going, we're testing out the new butthole spider. Joe, you can't laugh at your own bit directly in my eye line.
Yeah, no, that's just obnoxious.
Just obnoxious. Now, Jen Statsky, you write for this show. But I feel like you don't just write for this show.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad you're bringing this up.
Viewers may know you as an actor on this television program.
Yes, yeah. I had a real star-turning role in episode 111, where I play the cashier at the Mexican restaurant that Jason and Pillboy are trying to rob. Now, I have no interest in being an actor. I don't want to do it. I think it's very, I truly, genuinely think it's very difficult, and I commend anyone who can do it. And Mike Schur has a very bad habit of forcing people to act.
Is it forcing?
It's 100% forcing.
When he senses someone like Jen doesn't want to, then it suddenly happens. And now Josh Siegel's been in what, probably
five or six
most of the episodes.
Yeah, you know,
and he is mortified.
I only know Josh as an actor.
Yeah.
I've never worked with him as a writer.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I assume he can write, but.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like,
he's more of an actor.
For me, it was a thing where it was like, okay, it's one line, so you can't fork that up too much. With Josh, it was, I don't know if he talked about this in when he came on here, but with Josh, it was like, he did it at the table read, and he did it a couple times, and we were like, he's so good.
We were talking about casting this part, and we're like, what are we doing here? This guy
so
is
good.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. He's got a very specific, like, it's this sort of like, I don't know, syrupy and also kind of maternal. Like, what are we doing?
He's perfect. He's perfect
for a demon who's playing this very warm, cuddly person in the fake Good Place. It's perfect.
There's a great bit of sleight of hand where Jianyu produces what could be a magical amulet. Turns out not to be. Where did that come from?
That took a lot of time, actually. Yeah. We knew of the like joke structure before we landed on a bicycle gear, but the whole point was that we wanted something handed to Eleanor by Jianyu that looked very mystical, that she thought was some sort of amulet, something magical, because he's a monk who, you know, she's like assuming too much. And then you go back, and when you see his story, it's just a bicycle gear. It's nothing. It's just garbage. He literally hands her garbage. And then it was also a character trait that how quickly she realizes, like, oh, this is garbage.
And Kristen did such a funny job when she like realizes it's garbage and it's like, oh, this is nothing. This is garbage.
She's clutching it the whole episode.
One of the act breaks, I believe it's like the act two break, or where she's like, I know you're not a magic amulet, but please, if you are, like, she like makes a wish on it, and it's so funny.
Yeah, we did a single of it. We did a little camera move into it.
It's also one of those opportunities that you were talking about where you within the Rashomon, the different perspective thing, I think maybe you did it practically where Ted and Kristen walk away and she says, is continuing saying, like, what's the deal with the guy, with the gentleman in the nightgown or whatever she says. There was another one of those handoffs sort of story.
That was one of the moments. That was like one where you didn't see Jianyu first and then, we saw it from Ted's perspective later.
Right.
Yeah. This episode had a great opportunity for Tia Sirkar as no longer real Eleanor. now she's taken on the character of Denise, the pizza lady.
Yeah, she's not happy about it.
Not happy about it.
Yeah.
That she is like an ambitious actress as a demon is such a fun game.
Yeah.
Trying on a limp. There are accents later, right?
Yes, right.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked a lot about, as we were kind of breaking this episode, of Michael being like a indie film director who the crew and actors are getting away from him, and he's just trying to like control the chaos. So it made us laugh to think of her just getting super into acting.
And then being stuck with a smaller role and then still trying to weasel her way into the main story just striking out.
The way she even delivers pizza in a jilted way to, I think, Angelique. She's like, here, Chidi, this one's for you. And she
flings the pizza.
It's great. Yeah.
You took my part, basically. That's what we were saying. Yeah.
How do you shoot a sequence like Ted reaching down Darcy's throat?
It's so unimpressive on the day.
Really?
It's really just like Ted's hand disappearing behind Darcy's neck.
It's the thing where you are fooling a kid by saying like, oh, I'm my pen is upstage of my mouth and I'm eating the pen.
Yeah. Okay. It pretty much is. Like, there wasn't a lot to it, was there?
No,
really? It doesn't look like.
So he didn't do that for real.
Spoiler, no, he did not. Yeah. No, yeah.
I mean, Darcy I mean, can did on the first unhinge from a jaw like, right. a, yeah, like yeah. a snake, but yeah. it ended up, like, it will just do it with computers.
Yeah, we did have like a previz of it. We did have like a little animation of what it was going to look like.
Yeah.
I remember that. Like it was one of our VFX guys, and I think with his kid was
Ninago and his daughter.
Yeah, yeah, they did like a little test one. And so we knew what it was going to look like, but it wasn't even as precise as you would think. Like it was really just Ted's hand going through, and then it wasn't like the hand had to hide behind Darcy or mm-hmm. anything like that. It was really...
Yeah, it's amazing what our visual effects, David Nagle, can do with our show.
I would say it's one of my favorite things about working
and
on the show.
It's a big part of it, because the show does have almost like... The unlimited kind of potential of what could happen mm-hmm. is like, you know, almost a little like in animation. You know, there's like stuff like opening someone's mouth and putting in, you know, and Joe, your character, the fire.
Yeah,
the
fire monster, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I'm not the only actor on the show.
That's right.
I'm the only non-actor yet to be.
Truth be told, we did try to give Trent an acting role in season 3 and he turned it down, so...
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. That's true, except it was I didn't turn it down, but everything else about
Yeah, no. So I'm an actor first, and I would just like that on the record.
You're a real Josh. I don't know if you know it.
He wishes.
It's pretty great. Now, Hollywood and a film set, a television show set, can make strange relationships. I just learned that you made friends on the set of The Good Place.
I did. I took one of the actors home. this is true. Will was chatting to someone else. William Jackson Harper was chatting to someone at Craft Services about trouble in his apartment, and he was getting like kicked out, and I think because of the dog maybe. Anyway, he lived at the
show doesn't pay very well.
Anyway, so he was having to leave, and this was like 30 seconds before we were like had to be back on set. Mm-hmm. And I just turned to him and said, oh, I live really close by and my family's gone back to Australia for a little while. You can come and live there if you want. And he kind of like looked at me and then said he'll think about it, and then we kind of like sussed each other out, like whether we wanted to date or not.
Sure, yeah.
For the rest of the week, and then he, like another week later, he came up to the house, and we were very happy. We had a good.
You cohabitated. He house sat.
So what happened was my wife was back in Australia, so Will moved in, and then I still had the kids for a second, and then I went back to Australia and left him at the house.
Okay.
And I took the kids to Australia, and then I came back, and it was just me and Will.
Everyone was wondering whether you took the kids or whether you left your kids with Will.
Yeah.
There were 3 seconds just then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, it was, it weirdly all worked out, and it was fun. It was also, it was weird when I was finished on the show, uh-huh. and it was like, you know, when I'd finished my block, but Will would still be going to work, mm-hmm. and I'd sort of ask about everyone and how his day was. Yeah.
How are the other directors doing?
Yeah.
Like a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. How many takes do they do? How many wides? Oh. They do a lot of wides.
Would you live with Drew? I'm just wondering how he would be as a roommate.
But that worked out. It was just a one season thing. Like we haven't done it again.
I don't know. I think it's cool.
It's open.
Hollywood's such a small town, and I think it's just another example of the benefit of finding yourself saying yes. Like, you didn't have to offer that. He didn't have to say yes, but cool stories emerge.
Yeah.
I think it's neat. Jen, I've been instructed to ask you the origin of Ya Basic.
Oh man. Okay. So it's a very weird story. I'll try to make it as concise as possible. Basically,
it's a podcast, so we have limited time.
Yeah. Darcy and I, I've known Darcy for a while. Darcy and I are very good friends even before the show.
What's a while? How long's a while?
Well, we really became super close when we both moved to LA, which was in early 2013.
Okay.
I kind of knew her. We run in the same like New York circle of UCB people. And so I knew her back in New York when we both lived there, but we weren't super close. But then when we moved here in 2013, we moved to LA like weirdly in the same month, I think. And we had a double date with my husband and her husband and she and I, and we fell in love. So flash forward many years later, I think it was 2015, I want to say. It was definitely, but right before this show started, maybe 2016, we go to see a Beyonce concert at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena.
We had started writing because you
came.
Oh,
we had started writing.
Yeah,
okay,
it was early on because
writing.
You told this story and then it worked
right, I told
its
this
way.
Story yeah. in the writer's yeah. room. So we go, we see Beyonce. We're super psyched. We have good seats. It's really great. The guy next to us is a man, like a young, like 20-something. He's like a stage mom to Beyonce. The entire show, he's criticizing Beyonce's performance out loud, being like, this isn't good enough. You can do better than this. What are you doing? Like, it was one of the craziest things I've ever experienced
in
my life.
Was he within earshot? Could she see or hear?
She could not hear. We had good seats, but we weren't like up. Like, yeah. He was yelling at nothing. So he does this the entire show. Darcy and I are losing our minds because it's crazy. It's crazy person behavior. Yeah. I'm like, A, this is ruining the show, but B, it's the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me in my life. So at one point she does, Prince had passed away a few months, I think, earlier, and she plays a Prince song as like a tribute to him. She doesn't even sing it. They just play the song and he yells, he goes, now this is real music. And so finally, I think we both were just like, dude, what's up? What's going on? Are you a Beyonce fan? Why are you here? And he was like, I love her. I just know she can do better than this. It was crazy. So basically, he does that the entire show. The girls behind him start yelling at him, getting very upset about him. It's I'm no longer paying attention to the concert. And so... And so I don't even remember what it was, but he starts yelling at the girls behind us at the very end of the show. And Darcy, very nicely, very kind, lovely person, as we all know,
yes,
tries to say something. She tries to say, like, hey, man, like, chill out or something. Like, you're being crazy. And he does this amazing thing where he turns to her. He looks her up and down, like, scans her, like, takes stock of who everything she is as a person, her essence, what her worth, and goes, yeah, basic. And Darcy and I just were like, oh my. I was like, it is like in the show. I'm like, you're devastated.
Yeah,
that's devastating. And so it was just crazy. And so I came into the writer's room with that story like that Monday and told everyone. And we just started saying, you're basic all the time.
Because
it was amazing.
Yeah, it's like the ultimate insult.
Yeah. And then we were like, yeah, Eleanor has to say this. It needs to be part of the show. So that is the origin of you're basic.
Tough night for Beyonce and Darcy.
Oh my goodness.
Very critical guy.
You don't say that often.
What?
Tough night for Beyonce tough night for Darcy.
Trent O'Donnell, what's good?
What's good? You know what? This is dumb, but it's been rattling in my head. I took my kids to a baseball game last week, and we left at like as long as kids can stand it. My son's actually obsessed, but my daughter's like likes food, and we left, and we were like in seats that were like they were actually kind of cheap. They weren't great seats, but they were like close down past first base.
Is this Dodgers?
Yeah,
very nice.
It's the Dodger Stadium, and then. So we left after the singing, after the seventh inning, the middle of it, and because I know that's where the singing is.
Mm-hmm.
And we left our seats and walked up, and we would have only been like 20 feet from our seats, and a foul ball went into the seat where my daughter was sitting.
Good heavens.
At like 100 mile an hour.
Yeah.
And she actually looked at me and went, Dad, would have caught that. And I just like walked away. It like rattled around in my head going, is that like the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me?
Wow. Maybe. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because I think I replayed it for ages going, I was like three seats away. I couldn't have got across there and no one in front, like there was a guy with a glove in the row in front and he cowered to get out of the
it
way.
Came
of
it came that fast.
Yeah. Like flew off the bat super quick and went into the seat like,
oh my
so
God.
Hard. And I just think, wow, that was kind of like that was a good, I think we left at the exact right time.
Moments earlier.
Yeah. So yeah, baseball
was good.
Baseball was good.
In conclusion,
but you don't believe
baseball
in,
good.
In God or the afterlife. You'd think after
no,
this
I believe
it would
in
be...
luck, I think.
Okay. Luck. Yeah. All right.
So luck is good, everyone.
Jen Statsky, what's good?
What's good? I will go with a animal rescue group here in Los Angeles called A Purposeful Rescue, which is a group that I adopted a dog from last year. And the thing that's very cool about them is that they kind of specialize in adopting older dogs. a lot of people, when they adopt dogs, they want like a puppy or a younger dog, which is totally, I get it and understandable. And I have a younger dog too. But adopting a like 11-year-old, 12-year-old dog has been such a joy. They're so chill and awesome. And it's very cool to see. So A Purposeful Rescue is the group. They do awesome work here in LA. Check them out on Instagram and online and donate to them. And if you're looking for a dog, they're a great resource.
Joe Mandy, what's good?
So pour over coffee. It's 52 grams of freshly ground coffee to 750 milliliters of water at 209 degrees Fahrenheit.
Sure.
So not just before. No, I did a charity last time. I'm going to say the TV show Forged in Fire.
Oh, interesting.
I'm obsessed with it.
I know this program.
I can't stop watching it. I think I've now seen every episode. It's good.
This is a show, I think, on history.
It's on the history. It's very historical. And what it is they bring four lunatics who make knives and swords in their backyard forges. And it's like Chopped with swords.
Mm-hmm. They will give them a challenge and say, you have to make this kind of knife out of a brake drum.
A car.
Yeah.
And then they have to like saw off pieces of a car and melt them down and then make a sword out of it.
I almost tweeted the other day watching an episode that these guys are all doing it wrong. You should wear a giant overcoat filled with every kind of knife mm-hmm. and then just clank a bunch of stuff around mm-hmm. in the challenge period and then be like, here's my perfect knife.
Yes.
Forged in Fire is pretty fun.
Yeah.
Jen Statsky, Joe Mandy, Trent O'Donnell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. And now, to deliver our credit sequence, is Bad Janet. Take it away, Bad Janet.
Whatever. If you enjoyed this podcast, which, like, how is that even possible? Please subscribe. It's available on all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts. I don't even know. Or if you don't want to subscribe, you can also just listen to your mom's butt, you fat dink. You burnt.
Why don't I handle the credits? The podcast is hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Ew.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Who?
It's written by Lizzie Pace.
Okay.
And the music is composed by David Schwartz.
David Schwartz. See you next time, nerds.